This is Dr. Trina Coleman, host of Beyond the Classroom. Beyond the Classroom tends to serve a couple of functions. A, we appeal to the nerdiness inside people. B, we talk about the great work that our alums from HBCUs, and some of them are not from HBCUs, but we keep them anyway because they're doing good work at HBCUs, and how they go beyond their courses of study to help uplift our students at HBCUs, particularly those that are studying STEM-related disciplines. We also have special guests like today's guest, Dr. Michael Curry, who is doing his uplift in his education and his research and helping our students become scientists and also doing the entrepreneurial piece. So Dr. Michael Curry is with us today on Beyond the Classroom, and he's got a lot of great information he's going to talk about. He's going to talk about what he does. He's going to talk about what his students are working on, and he's going to tell us about his entrepreneurial pursuits. So welcome, Dr. Michael Curry, to Beyond the Classroom. Glad to have you on, and you're going to provide a lot of great information, so I can hardly wait to hear it. Let's start with you telling us about what you do in a little more detail than I just provided.
Okay, so let's see where I can start. First of all, I'm a small town. I was raised in a small town, so I'm a small town guy. My interest in science came from actually joining the military. I was in the United States Navy. I did power submarines for a few years of my life. And from there, I got an interest in science because they had the latest in all types of technology. And I became very curious as, hey, can I do this? Mm-hmm. And so I went to school in Alabama. After being away from home for so long, my mom wanted me closer. So I'm from Mississippi, so I came back to Alabama to go to school. I went to the University of West Alabama to get my BS in chemistry and mathematics, and then I was recruited to the University of Alabama, Roll Tide. I complete my doctoral degree in analytical chemistry with a focus on material science.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. How far away in miles were you from your mother? I'm about to call you Dr. Mama's boy.
I am a doctor's mama's boy.
All righty then. So continue.
Yes. After going to the University of Alabama, to complete my doctorate in analytical chemistry with a focus on material science, my advisor, we all thought that I was going to a national lab because it was obvious that I was very good at the research as a graduate student. Fortunately, I got a chance to teach and found, you know, a great love for imparting knowledge and then also taking students into the lab and showing them exactly what they can do if they harness their skills. I was actually recruited to go to Tuskegee University in 2009 by Dr. Gregory Pritchett, who was the chair of the chemistry department there at that time. And one of the things he told me was that, hey, we can really use your skills at the HBCU setting. One of the things that he was trying to do in his department was increase the number of African-American representatives there doing research and exposing the students to high-quality research. And so I went there, gave an interview, was super impressed with the students after my interview with the questions that they posed to me. And I actually said, yes, I'm coming here to do research with your students. And so that's how I ended up at Tuskegee University doing research there. My research is focused on green-based technology. I look at developing bio-based materials that are eco-friendly, that can be biodegradable, and applied to plastic technology.
Okay, that sounds awesome. So you're talking about stuff like the disposable straws and stuff like that are being made, or?
Correct. So recently, I was in D.C. at the EARN conference, as you guys call it, but
what does EARN stand for?
Okay, so EARN stands for Emerging Researchers National Conference on STEM.
Yes.
So I was there, and I was actually at the restaurant inside the hotel, and they gave me a straw, and it was paper.
Yes.
So I learned quickly that, okay, that in D.C., they're no longer using plastic. They're trying to get away from plastics. And I was like, wow, you know, that kind of set the realization for me that people are actually trying to now move away from this toxic substance. even when I went to the store, they asked me, I was buying some items from the store, and they were saying, do you want a plastic bag or do you want a paper bag? Because for the plastic bag, you had to pay an extra charge, right? Mm-hmm. So that was another realization that set in. And so I was thinking about the invention that we just made a discovery at Tuskegee in my group, was a process by which you could make plastics biodegradable. So we can make plant-based plastics that are biodegradable and eco-friendly, and then we can make petroleum-based plastics that biodegrade as a composite, and then make mm-hmm. that petroleum-based recyclable. And so okay. now we don't have that problem anymore.
I'm going to ask a political question. I know that there are ways that things can be made more efficient and more environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. Big energy and those companies tend to try to run interference on people that are doing good work like you to avoid having these products come to market. I know you're a scientist and you're in the lab, but has any of that impacted your work as far as getting stuff done? Because energy companies don't want us to be efficient because that cuts their bottom line.
Right. So, you know, as a researcher, I'm forced to start to think about things like that. And when we're doing our research, and mm-hmm. how do we get around those roadblocks? Yeah. And so one thing that we did in my group was, instead of going against the tide, we wanted to go with the tide.
You had to say tide again, right? We're not talking about the tide right now.
No, we're talking about the tide that rolls in through the shore.
you didn't roll in there with the tide.
Okay. Right. So instead of, you know, going against, you know, what the big energy companies are going against, so we tried to develop a process that would enhance what's already out there. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we look at the big plastic companies. And so we wasn't trying to disrupt what they were doing. We were trying to add to what they were actually doing. It's been very receptive so far in the industry, because we've had contact from places like Patagonia. We have a meeting with them sometime this week, I think. And they're looking at how can they help us to get our products to commercialization. We have had a meeting with new composite partners out in Wisconsin. We actually went out there when it was negative 26 degree weather.
What?
And, yeah, we stepped off the plane. It was negative 26. And think about it. We're coming from
Alabama to negative 26. Oh, no.
We left 79 degree weather and stepped off the plane. It was negative 26 degree weather. It was me, my COO, and my DPR. We were looking around like, oh, my God.
Are we still in the United States?
Operation Deep Freeze is on.
Where was that tide that was rolling in when you got rolling tide up in there?
Yeah, that tide had frozen. But we went out. It was a little town called Edgerton, Wisconsin. We mm-hmm. went out there and we met with a really nice guy named, his name is Ron, and mm-hmm. He's been in the industry for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And, he's helping us to move our material to USDA to get it USDA preferred, so that mm-hmm. people have to start using our materials. And he's basically opened up his Rolodex to us to help us,
find awesome
solutions. So it's been very receptive. Mm-hmm. We haven't really, you know, found any pushback just yet.
That's great. Are any of your students working with you specifically on your endeavors from an entrepreneurial standpoint?
So I have one student who will be coming on. So the student name is Donald White. He's from San Francisco, California, mm-hmm. or close in the Bay Area.
And mm-hmm. You know, you probably shouldn't have said what his name was, because somebody's going to try to steal him from you.
But I wish him all the best. They've already been trying to steal him. His story is so unique, because this young man comes from a background that says that he shouldn't be, you know, here where he's at right now. And mm-hmm. the fact that he, you know, triumphed all odds and made a discovery in a center. So we was part of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. And Tuskegee was the HBCU in the center. Right. Mm-hmm. All the other, you know, universities was well established, like University of Illinois, Wisconsin, Northwestern, all these well established universities. But he went in, he held his own. He made a discovery, which has kind of went viral all over the world. And it just it's very exciting to see young men mm-hmm. at HBCUs, you know, do such exciting work and make such discoveries that are vetted. Our discovery actually, when he made it, was actually kind of denied for a little bit until mm-hmm. it was vetted at Johns Hopkins and University of Wisconsin through the center. Mm-hmm.
Did they ask you who you stole it from? I mean, you know, because that sounds to me, you know, the thing about it is when amazing things happen at HBCUs, which have, they've been happening since the start of HBCUs. That was where we made amazing discoveries and contributions because we couldn't make them anywhere else. I mean, there was a handful that could and did go to other schools. But, you know, as we move forward in time, and, you know, it's almost incredulous to some people that good things can come out of HBCUs. That burns me. And it really does. But, you know, when students like those come along or students like you and I come along,
right,
it's like we're all unicorns. And that's one of the things that, you know, Beyond the Classroom is about, having people like you that help uplift them from our perspective. Because it takes everybody's hands to hold them up.
Right. It takes a village. It does take a village.
We need more village.
But I will say that, you know, I have to give credit. And I've been in a lot of centers. Mm-hmm. And this first center where the leader of the center, who was Dr. Robert Hammers, and we call him Bob. Mm-hmm. He owns his own company called Silotronics. But mm-hmm. he actually, when the discovery was made, he actually, and we had this whole debate about, you know, who gets credit for the discovery, where, you know.
That was my next question.
How this whole IP thing rolls out.
Mm-hmm.
He woke up as the leader of the center and said, hey, if something is discovered at Tuskegee, it belongs to Tuskegee.
To Tuskegee.
Right? If something is discovered at Wisconsin, it belongs at Wisconsin. And so he showed impeccable leadership, you know, in the center, and that really, you know, impressed me a lot that he was willing to stand up and say, okay, this is how this is going to roll out.
Mm-hmm. That's good, because I had this conversation a couple weeks ago, but once again, it still is relevant to have in 2019. It was relevant to have in 1999, but intellectual property policies are something that need to be taken seriously. They need to be looked at. They need to be developed if they don't exist. And they need to be robust enough that you don't drive away good researchers like yourself because you don't see value for yourself to make this awesome discovery that can change the world and be like pushed to the side. And, you know, it's like Tuskegee, the entire unit of Tuskegee developed it or discovered it.
Right.
And it's like, oh yeah, by the way, and Michael Curry, he published a couple papers on it. But, you know, right. and a book, you know, and we might have given him a better office and $10. I mean, but, you know, for real, IP properties need to be looked at holistically and individually. From the standpoint of, I don't know if administration is, I don't know. I just know that it's not, and I'm not going to say across the board because I'm sure every university has different policies in place.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the larger universities, they do things, obviously, that are financially rewarding to their researchers when their researchers come and do the work. Right. And they're able to give back. And you know, acquire whatever wealth comes along with their work.
Right.
And they tend to open their wallets up a little bit wider.
Right.
To give back to the university as opposed to having a gun in their back saying, right. You know, if you want to use our stuff, here's how this is going to go. Right. We're going to keep everything that comes out of your brain. And if you used our stapler, that means it's ours.
Right. And, you know, and I think, you know, at least I can say for at Tuskegee and at Stillman, where my company sits now, after interacting with the president here, but at Tuskegee, they are trying to incentivize faculty to, you know, bring those inventions forward to and to trust in the university.
Mm-hmm.
Shaikh Jelani, who's the dean of, you know, graduate school and the VP of research there, actually he formulated with the rest of the administration a plan and put together where the faculty now has 50% ownership of the IP.
That's and great.
So that's kind of like incentivizing them now. We want you to go start a company with it.
Into right. perpetuity. That means it's theirs. They die, their kids own it. Right. I mean, you know, that's the way it should be. This is yours. You right. pay us residuals. We don't right. pay you residuals. You pay us residuals.
Mm-hmm.
Technology transfer and the management of that under the university umbrella is something that I guess you guys are a little bit farther ahead than others.
Actually, well, we're starting to build our tech transfer office. I mean, no, they're putting in the efforts. They're putting in the manpower to create this tech transfer office because, I mean, on one hand, you want to incentivize the faculty to go out to produce this great work and to turn into a company. And then on the other hand, now you got to be able to facilitate and, you know, them with getting this company started. And part of that is being, you know, license agreement, joint agreements,
mm-hmm.
all those things have to take place. And so one of the things that I realized quickly with my discovery, because my discovery is actually probably one of the first discoveries that's going to come out with a product from since Carver. And so one of the things I realized really quickly was that they didn't train me to be an entrepreneur. They trained me to be a researcher.
Exactly.
I'm good at that. And so one of the things that I had to do was I took a page out of Obama's book when he became president. I had to surround myself with the best, with the starting five.
Mm-hmm. And so, an attorney.
Right.
Or two attorneys.
Right.
Patent and contract.
Right. And so, you know, I actually was very fortunate to bump into a guy by the name of Isaac McCoy, who's dean at Stillman College in the business department. And he actually worked for the Obama administration.
Hmm.
So he's been speed dating me on business and entrepreneurship, and I've learned so much. And one of the things I want to do is now take that back, right? Because think about it. You know, the university, we want you to become an innovator and an entrepreneur because obviously the university benefits when you, you know, go down that path and you as a professional and your students also benefit, but we got to start providing the necessary training. And, yes. and so that means that now we got to start becoming innovative in our classrooms.
Yes. So
how we display materials to our students, how we teach them about, you know, the science, and we got to teach them about the entrepreneurship. How do we know that we have something that's innovative, and how do we know it's commercializable, and how do we know it's going to solve this, you know, a problem in the world? So we got to start training them.
We need to start training them, and also it needs to be an interdisciplinary effort because the business school needs to get involved. And the students in the business school need to get involved. And there should be patent and trademark classes in somewhere in that entrepreneurship curriculum.
Right.
And you know, one of the things I wanted to do is give a shout out to one of my colleagues, Dr. Jamie Valentine Miller. Yes, Jamie, you're getting a shout out. She is a PhD physicist. She works for the Patent and Trademark Office. Mm-hmm. And so, having someone who can guide you, and yeah, I'm volunteering Jamie now to see if I can tap her for, you know, some of her knowledge and see if there's a way she can talk about it, because I am going to have her on Beyond the Classroom because of the work she does. Back to the IP stuff and the discoveries and doing the thing the right way, you know, there's a lot of components and moving pieces that have to fit together just right. And yes. if you don't know, you don't know.
Right.
And you find out at the wrong time.
Yes.
You needed to know before you found out that you didn't know.
Right. So this should have been part of my training as a graduate student.
A whole lot of stuff should have been part of our training as STEM graduate students. We're right. not people friendly all the time. I mean, you know, there's other stuff, soft skills and also business skills, because we don't have the personality or the characteristics of those that are more savvy in general with dealing with stuff like that. We are of one mind. Let's solve problems. Solving problems is what we do. We right. don't think about how to take somebody else's problem and monetize it, or even take our problem after we solve it and monetize it. We're not thinking about it from a monetization right. Standpoint. And now we don't want to be broke scientists that prove that we're smarter than everybody else, because that's basically what That's been the goal. We're right. smarter than ever. I'm smarter than so-and-so. Really? How much is that paying you? You know, how you living? How you living? Being smart. You know, like back in the day when scholars were scholarly just because they like being scholarly and talking about stuff and creating and doing all that math and coming up with theorems and all of that. Quantum physics, and where's their estate? They don't have the, you know, they didn't get compensated accordingly for that work.
Right.
So now we need to start thinking on that compensation level. I'm not a rich scientist.
We don't have that business savvy mind going into it. That's why.
Yeah, and the rich ones aren't getting rich because of the scientists. They're getting rich because they got famous off of something else.
Right.
Not the science.
Right.
Fix that, Michael. You gonna fix all that? Fix that.
I'm trying. You know, through, like I said, through my company, it sits on a HBCU campus.
Yes. Say it again. I don't think my listeners heard you the first time when you said that. Which campus does your company sit on?
It sits on Stillman College campus in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and it's an HBCU.
Yes, we know that. I just want to make sure you said which one.
Right. Well, the president actually invited, I was actually going to go out of town, and the president invited me onto the campus because she saw my second mission, which was to interface with HBCU colleges and universities to try to make them more sustainable in the way that, you know, we do our business. And she thought we would be it would be a great match. And so far it has been an excellent match. And I'm using them, Stillman is kind of like the prototype. Started to interface with their courses. For instance, I interface with the art course. And so, you know that show called So You Think You Can Dance?
Yes.
So we came up with this
idea. Cannot.
So
can you?
Yes, I can dance very well.
Oh, Lord. They taught you that in the Roll Tide, huh? You can roll the tide. Okay. No.
So you think you can dance.
That's where you left off. Okay. Right.
So You Think You Can Dance, and we came up with this title, So You Think You Can Design. And so the art students are now, so I brought them in, I gave them a lecture on 3D printing and a little stuff, and now, so they're going back, they're using CAD files to design something for the alumni. Right?
Okay.
And it's really nice. And it's going to be 3D printed by my company. And then I tasked the business department to now they have to market the design. So they're interfacing with the art department and my company. And so now I'm going to go to the science department and say, okay, now how can you make it better? How can you make it more, you know, colorful, more interesting, you know, so that the alumni would want to purchase it, right? And so kind of interfacing with all those disciplines, giving them, you know, that innovation piece that they're missing so that they can see that, okay, this goes beyond, you know, the typical classroom.
Yes, I like this. Lit it right on in.
But yeah, right. You go beyond the typical classroom and provide them, you know, to see the bigger concept. Because one thing that I pride my advisor when I was a graduate student on, even though we was focused on our research, he always made us look at the bigger concept, right? So why are we doing this? Actually, are we trying to solve a problem? Is this fundamental research or is this research that we're trying to actually solve a problem?
Apply
research, right? And so you know, I credit him for that, being able to give me that, you know, that view of things. And so now I just apply it to my classes, right?
That's great.
Tuskegee, you know, I always try to, when I teach, I always try to provide real world examples, and not only just real world example. Now, where is this being used at currently to provide some innovation for you?
Okay. And one of the other things that, while you were discussing how the process worked there, is the fact that I thought about the collaborative efforts that the students have to work together. So they have to be able to speak each other's language at some level. They don't have to be experts in everybody's field, but they have to be able to work together.
Right.
And that gives them real life skills moving forward. Mm-hmm. And that also probably helps the science students a little bit so that they can kind of get to a point where they can explain their work to other people that are not knowledgeable about it.
Right.
And that's one of the exercises that I try to do when I'm interfacing with a group of undergraduate students that are doing research, like the research you're doing. I'm like, okay, First of all, I know nobody in your family understands what you do. Right. So you, I know that already. Right. Been there, done that. Your project that you're working on, especially if I'm at a conference like EARN, mm-hmm. and they're standing there next to their nice posters, and they're like, I know all of this stuff on this poster, all these graphs, charts, and all of that. I'm like, okay, explain to me the title of your research in terms that a regular person can relate to that have never seen any of this stuff before. Tell me what this means. And they struggle hard. I'm like, you can't use the word doping, you know? Like if doping is in the title or something, you gotta explain what that is to somebody. What is doping? Because they think it's somebody, you know, take steroids or something. You know, explain what doping is or whatever the term is that, you know, just rolls off their tongue when they're talking to their colleagues. And that's part of being a professor, as you know.
Right.
Because when I was teaching general physics and calculus-based physics, astronomy, whatever it was that I was teaching, you have to break it down to them into terms they can relate to. You got to break it down. And you have to be able to do it on the spot and be able to explain a concept in like regular terms. Right. So, yeah, that sounds like a great mix to be able to have those types of programs. I'm going to get back on track now, where the students are working together with different disciplines. So mm-hmm. the material students have to let the business students know what the product does, how it does it. Mm-hmm. So when they start doing a marketing effort or whatever, or if they're doing the IP side of it, then they know what they're working with, as right. opposed to just being words on the page.
Right.
So that's right. pretty cool.
Yes.
That's pretty cool. Has anybody crossed over from business into science?
Well, we just started, so I'm not sure how.
So they're banging on. They'll be banging on your door soon. We don't want to do business anymore. We want to do materials. No, they won't. I'm just messing. They should be. But you will probably. Your program sounds so innovative that recruitment should not be a problem because people want to try to make their ideas come to life.
Right. Well, actually, you know, ever since I've been here on the campus, so I've been here a little over probably a month and a half now, and I've seen students walking by, you know, seeing like, oh, wow.
You have toys.
Hey, like, what is this? I'm like, this is a 3D printer. So mm-hmm. they come by and they're very interested, and I'm like, yeah, I'll be interfacing with your class soon. And they're like excited. They can't wait, right? It's like, mm-hmm. new, you know, what is this going to entail? And so it's very exciting for me because I get to share my work and I get to share, you know, my passion, but I get to share it in a way, like you say, that's understandable to the students. So often, you know, we as professors, we go into the classroom and we forget that we're talking to students who probably just came out of high school, who's used to their mother taking care of them, or, you know, who's not really had much to do on their own. As far as, you know, trying to get themselves ready to master a concept or master, you know, or tackle some problem that they're going to have to solve. And so, like you said, we really got to start to change the way that we actually approach our students and trying to educate them. I give you one example in a class that I always use when we're talking about covalent bonding. Students always get confused on how this works. So I tell them, I said, listen, can we just talk about money for an instance? And they'd be like, money? I was like, yeah, just bear with me. And so we talk about, you know, money in bank accounts, and when you're sharing a bank account, who does the money belong to? And they go, oh, okay, so you mean if I have $6 in my account and I share an account with somebody who has $2, I have access to $8, but I only have $6 that belongs to me. I'm like, correct. That's covalent bonding. Right? Like, wait a minute, so you're saying that this belongs to this? I'm like, yes. It's like, oh, I get it now, right?
That's
so
great.
We think that it's so petty. Like when I first started, you're thinking, why should I lower myself to explain, because that's so petty. But it is the petty stuff that actually gets students knowledge going, get them thinking and get them, you know, turned on to science.
Well, science is so visual. I mean, the math is there, but you have to visualize it first. Right. And that's one of the things that I enjoyed about studying quantum theory, mm-hmm. is that I could see in my mind what was happening. And I could see what the possibilities and the probabilities and all of those things. And it was just fun to me to look at it and try to do that process in my brain. And I know there's a term for it. So they use it on TV now with all these genius doctors and stuff. And they have all these models and holographic stuff going on around their heads. But it's visualization. And then you can figure out how to solve that problem. So that's pretty cool that you can break it down, because you have to. And then they can see for themselves what is going on. Then once you see it, you can solve it, which is the truth. So, dang, I want to take your class. No, I do not. I probably already take it. I have all my notes over here. I can teach a class. That would certainly be fun. I come in and get on the Zoom and we can do class together. That would be excellent, actually. I would love to do that, because it sounds like you're having so much fun.
I try. I just look at how I learn. When I'm having fun, I'm learning.
Yes.
So I'm pretty sure.
And you're teaching.
Right. And I'm teaching. Right. And so when I'm having fun, I'm sure the students are having fun.
Yes.
To me, I hate dry lecture. I hate just going in and just dry lecture. I have to interact with my students, because so many students, one of the things I learned, my wife was an elementary teacher. And I watched her go through her process of how she prepared her lectures. And she takes every child into consideration. Like, this child is on this level, so I got to incorporate something in for that. And so I would help her prepare, and it taught me that not everybody learns the same. You can't just go in there with a PowerPoint. You just can't go in there and go to the board. Some people have, audio. There's a variety of things that goes into making a good lecture so that everybody in that room can pick up something that will allow them to progress.
And you have to be a good lecturer. And that's another thing that is important to me with students in presentation skills. Yes. Got to have them. I'm like, okay, if I'm in a presentation with someone and the first slide comes up after the title and it's got like, I have a dream speech on it because it got so much text up. Really? Did you put the "I have a dream speech" on this one slide? Stuff like that is not good. You're supposed to be speaking to the audience. The visual aids are supposed to be visual aids, not you reading from. And I know I'm offending somebody, but learn from what I'm telling you. Put the "I have a dream speech" on the slide. You will lose your students. I mean, especially if you're giving them stuff that's in their text that they can read on their own.
I have one positive. I tell them, I want you to bring your text to class, but it's only when I tell you to open it, it's when I want you to open it. I said, I know what's in the book. My job is to take what's in the book and break it down to simple terms. So that if you go back and read, you will understand. And so, I don't really allow my students to open their books unless I'm directing them
to look at something in particular. Absolutely. Right. Because if you're the subject matter expert in the room.
Right.
And you should have in the classroom mastered that material so that beyond the classroom that you happen to be back in, but in a different role, you are able to transmit and translate that information to your students in a manner that they can understand it, take it, apply it, and do something new with it, such as what you're doing now. And about to blow up and put Stillman College on the map. I mean, no, they're already on the map. They're an HBCU. I'm going to take that back. But you're going to be the drum major for how entrepreneurship and academics can coexist peacefully, hopefully. Peacefully is the operative word in that sentence. Everybody needs to be on board with the plan. And the plan, there should only be one plan, not one that they tell you about, and then the one that they discuss when you leave.
I have to say that President Ward, who's the president of Stillman College, has been very accommodating, a very open book. She has allowed me, free range on interfacing with her academics, and she's been very receptive to what I'm trying to do. And because I think that's kind of part of her goals as well, is to make her classrooms more innovative. Because face it, when you have an innovative campus, you want to come to your campus. Right. They know they can learn, and they know they when they leave, they can use that. They have talents that they can use.
Right. And your hands aren't tied.
And my hands are tied.
When it gets to a level where it's about trusting and allowing people to do what they do, right, and not interfering with them, especially if you don't even understand what they do, let you do your thing. Let you excite your students. Let you recruit more students because the other ones have told their colleagues or peers how awesome it is to be at Stillman and do work with you. And, the model that you guys have is, it's not traditional. So being able to have a non-traditional model that works, and it should be the standard, and it will be hopefully one day. But right now, I'm not mad at y'all at all. Do what works and set the tone for how things should be done from the scientific standpoint. And I think historically, going back to old scholars got jacked all the time for their stuff. Tesla got jacked for his stuff, and I speak on it often. It's just right now, scientists are wising up. Look, you're not just going to jack me for my stuff. I won't do anything with it. if I can't have it, you sure not going to have it. I'm just going to keep it over here until I can find someone who is going to be more fair about how we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. So now that you are in an environment where it appears as though fairness is aligned right there with learning and scholarship, it don't get no better than that, or does it? Is there better? What makes this better?
What makes this better? Okay, so there is better than this, and what makes this better is
what, when getting dropped off in the limo?
No,
I'm just messing with you.
It's when we can take a consortium of HBCUs.
I was thinking that, but I was scared to say it. Go ahead.
But that's where I'm going. So like I said, I'm working with the dean of business here, and we're trying to actually start an innovation center, an ideas center, right here on campus of Stillman College, where ideas flow in from HBCUs and products flow out, innovations flow out, right? And so,
you can see my face. Unfortunately, our listeners cannot. Listeners, by the way, this is Dr. Trina Coleman talking with Dr. Michael Curry here about STEM, intellectual property, the research he's doing with students at Stillman College, and how he's running a company on the campus, and how we can get our HBCUs more aligned with the reality that intellectual property tends to, most of the time, have a byproduct, which is a product, and who benefits financially and how equity is found with that effort, and having our HBCUs become more robust about having, entrepreneurship tied to science and math and, STEM subjects in general. So we're going to solve this problem here on Beyond the Classroom, and then it's going to be done. Me and Dr. Curry are going to fix it. We're going to have the help of a couple other people, but we're going to, at least impart some knowledge, hopefully, that will impact someone, be it a researcher or an admin or someone who works in HBCU or policymaker, that can help determine how we can move forward and how we can establish these consortiums as Dr. Curry is describing. So Dr. Curry, how do you get these HBCUs on board that you are, looking at as a cohort number one, so to speak? Right. How do you get cohort number one in place?
Right. So one of the things that, we got to kind of change the way that we do business. All right. What I mean by that is that we always look to leadership in the administration. There are faculty leaders who lead every day.
Yes.
So that's what we gotta harness that. A good friend of mine, who just became one of my good friends, Dr. Orlando Taylor, Stillman is part of CASEL. So Dr. Taylor has a NSF grant by the name of CASEL. Mm-hmm. And CASEL stands for the Center for the Advancement of STEM Leadership. And one of the things that he actually does is go in, look into the faculty rank, and he's looking for faculty leaders. And they actually cultivate those leaders on HBCU campuses. And so when he involves Stillman, the president asked me, would I be the liaison for Stillman with CASEL? And so I hosted Dr. Taylor down. And during that time we were talking about CASEL, I explained to him what I was trying to do with my company being sitting on the campus. And he thought that was just so amazing. And one of the things that he wished more HBCUs would get into, that he's actually was going to help me to facilitate what I'm trying to do on the campus. So using his network and his contact, because obviously he has a vast, amount of networks that he can tap me into.
Mm-hmm. That's my Hamptonian's role.
Yeah.
Proceed.
Yes. And so, like I said, so, and one of the things I took from him in talking to him was that, we always go to administration, but there are faculty leaders out there who lead every day. They're just not in an administrative role. And so if in order for this to work, so that means that now we got to tap into those faculty leaders, right? So we got to tap into those faculty leaders to get the ball rolling, to say, hey, do you want to be a part of something, much bigger? Do you want to be a part of something that's going to take your students to that next level?
And you, not just the students, but both.
Right, because one thing I want to be very real about is that, I just sat in about last year, towards the end of last year, at a PWI, where they're actually training their undergraduate STEM students about business. So their students are giving iCourse pitches, right?
Cool.
And they actually have a class on this, right? And they're developing these iCourse pitches for their technology. And I'm like, whoa, that was a setback for me, because I'm thinking, man, HBCUs are just, they're getting left behind because, we want the status quo. The status quo don't work anymore. We got to be willing to, excuse my French, but roll with the tide. we gotta roll with the tide.
I'm about to just disconnect. No, why? You could have said go with the flow. You could have said keep up with the times. You could have said oh my goodness. Okay.
All right. Well, but we seriously gotta change the way we do business. And
yeah, we do.
Look into those faculty. If we want to become more sustainable both financially and from an educational standpoint, then that means the status quo of business as it is has to change. And
yes.
So, look, and what I found is that when administrators have an enormous task already with running the university, and so approaching them with change, they look at that as, okay, now this is more work. And then who do I got to go against to try to make this change happen? And so it becomes a way out of their time and efforts, right? And now that team, you're going to lose.
But, and you have those people inside there that don't want it to happen. So they're like going behind you and undoing stuff and talking about why this won't work, even though they're nodding their head in the meeting.
Right.
Like, yes. That sounds like a fabulous idea.
Right.
Look, we ain't doing this. This is what I want you to do. Then over here, after that, we're going to kill this initiative right now. Right. Yeah.
So there would be an alternative route. So the alternative route is to get, the highly skilled faculty members involved and get them, sold on it. Because if you can get the faculty members involved, get them sold on it, get their students involved, and then you start to see the product of, what the students are producing coming out, then I believe administration will start to, move in that direction. So this first discovery that we made, I've been working on it since 2009.
See, that's 10 years.
2017.
Woo! That's a long time. This is Dr. Trina Coleman, and this is Beyond the Classroom. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Dr. Michael Curry. And Dr. Michael Curry is at Stillman College, and he runs his own company, and he mentors students, teaches classes, and makes cool discoveries about biodegradable materials, particularly plastics, and finding a use for them in our day-to-day lives so that we can make the Earth a more environmentally friendly place. Now, Dr. Curry, you mentor and advise how many graduate students right now?
So right now in my group, I have 2 graduate students and 4 undergraduate students. Okay, so, let's start with the graduate students. My group is kind of structured in an odd way. So one of the things that in my group, 2 things you have to be able to do. 1, you have to be able to do research. And then 2, you have to participate in what I call broadening your skills. And mm-hmm. then participating, like for instance, at ERN, the Maker Showcase. So we come up with innovations that we can go and showcase at different places. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of immersed the graduate students and the undergraduate students together as one, right?
Okay.
So it gives the undergraduate students that feel that they belong, and then it gives the graduate students the feel that, okay, I can mentor this person because I have a relationship with them.
Okay.
I found that works better. As far as the projects, the graduate students, yeah, they have their own separate projects, and it does go count towards their thesis work. Mm-hmm. And then the undergraduate play a role in their project. So the graduate student responsibility is to mentor the undergraduate students, but they get a separate piece of the pie out of the bigger, out of the larger, work. And so each undergraduate student has their own original being done, but it's under the mentorship of the person who's in charge of that project.
Okay. Well, that sounds great because it also gives the graduate students a head start on what being a research advisor looks like.
Right. So one of my students, so my students can have anywhere from, you know, from 1 to 5 undergraduate students working for them at any given time. Right now, we kind of, normally my group, so in the past, my group has been as large as 9 mm-hmm. graduate students. Right now, I only have 2 graduate students. I've graduated them all out pretty much and mm-hmm. put down this new venture, entrepreneurship. So I kind of, you know, shrunk my group a little bit to give me more time to do the entrepreneurship part. One of the things that I find that really helps the graduate student as far as getting them ready for the real world, because mm-hmm. you know, once they go out into the real world, it's no longer, hey, Dr. Curry is Dr. Finley or Dr. White, whoever, you know, I'm graduating. And I make them plan. So I make them sit down. I say, okay, I'm giving you this student. I'm paying the student. You got to give me the value for my money. So now you got to give me 2 values. You got to give me the value for my money, and now your worker, employee, got to give me the value for my money, or I'm going to take away your employee. So you got to give me a schedule of what they're going to be doing, when you're meeting with them, when we're going to meet together, their productivity, what you expect them to have done, you know, within the next 2 weeks. So they have to sit out and make that plan.
Wow.
In the midst of them making that plan, they always come back to me and say, Dr. Curry, your job is hard.
Not only that, it sounds like to me, then you do employee evaluations.
I actually
know you do.
Listen, I actually make them sit down and talk to the student and evaluate the student, tell them about mm-hmm. their performance. And one of the things I try to train them is you always approach with a positive. Because if you approach with a positive, that lowers the defenses, right?
Exactly.
And you tell them what they're doing good first, because you're not in military always told us what we're doing bad. Don't matter. If you do it in 2 minutes, they want it done in 1.5 minutes. I mean, that's just the way the military operates.
Mm-hmm.
The military. So tell the students what they're doing well, and then you telling them how to improve on what they did wrong.
Let's go back a little bit to the, I don't think we closed on that consortium piece that you were talking about mm-hmm. with the entrepreneurship and building that whole infrastructure and taking your model and expanding it to get other HBCUs involved so that we can start looking at a new normal. So tell me how you envision that is happening.
So, you know, the way I envision it is that, you know, we got to prove that the model works, right? And I'm in the correct place to prove that the model works at Stillman College. Like I said, the president here is phenomenal. and she's open-minded, and you know, it's just not something I've ran into a lot in my career as a professional at the HBCU networks. And you know, aligning myself with the right people who can help me to move this forward, like Dr. Orlando Taylor. Mm-hmm. You know, aligning myself with the right people who can help me to move this model forward and to show that it works, right, is the key. You know, I envision maybe, you know, starting here in Alabama, you know, with schools, the HBCU network here, and then starting to expand outward towards, you know, incorporating other HBCUs, right? Right, so this young lady at the conference gave me her card. I don't have it on me now, but she was like, I explained to her what I was doing at Stillman College, and she was like, oh, sign me up, right? I want to do something like this. I just never knew how to approach it from, you know, to take it to the administration. And I'm thinking, you know, when something goes to administration, it has to, you have to already show data to show that, you know, going this way, because like you said, there's no logic in administration.
I'm glad you agree with me. You
have to, no, I mean, because I went to administration before and presented stuff, and
mm-hmm. they looked at you like you lost your mind.
Yeah, they looked at me like I lost my mind. So I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're going to have the data there to support what you're trying to do, to show that, hey, this is working. You know, what I would imagine was, or is, would be this story next year in college. Innovation is starting to happen. Students starting to progress. Products are starting to come out of the college. Uh-huh. They're financially and, you know, educationally sound. And then you go into another HBCU, recruiting them on, you know, starting the innovation center where, you know, like we say, we have this incubation center, this idea center where, uh-huh. you know, ideas come in, products go out, you can get training, you know, all of the above. And then, other HBCUs coming on. So it's going to have to be an inward, outward type thing to get the HBCUs on board. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, proof of concept. And then once we get proof of concept, you know, pulling on the necessary faculty from other HBCUs to get ourselves implemented and not trying to go through the administration, you know, trying to work from the bottom up instead of the top down is one of the things I think we're going to have to do.
Well, every administration is different.
Correct.
Every scientific department or school is different. Mm-hmm. So are you trying to align specifically just based on geography, or are you trying to find the best match for what you guys have? And also, nothing is confirmed unless you try it if it's new. So looking at that's the other issue that comes up. It's like people, well, I mean, not generalized. There is a fear sometimes to try something new because it's new. So how do you get past that? Because if you don't try something new because it's new, you will never find out if it's going to be successful because you're staying in that safe zone. And the longer you stay in the safe zone, the farther behind you will be with respect to others that are trying new stuff.
You know, here's what I find. Having both experience at working at a PWI as a professor and at an HBCU, mm-hmm. here's where I find the difference is. At a PWI, like you said, they don't stay in the safe zone. They're always looking for new ways to enhance their programs, enhance their research, you know, mm-hmm. innovativeness, enhance their student skills. At HBCUs, we stay in the safe zone by saying that this has worked for so many years. Why do we want to change it now? But we don't look outside and look at our counterparts, how they're growing. And mm-hmm. yes, it's still working, but you're still at the same level of students that you were, you know, in 1990.
Mm-mm. No, you have fewer students now.
Oh, you have fewer students, right? You have fewer mm-hmm. students. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, it's still working for a small population, but it's not growing your population. As a matter right. of fact, matter of fact, if you look at it now, statistically, and I was looking this up, I think it's like 90% of, you know, minorities are going towards PWIs now, even though HBCUs were established to, you know, addressed education in minority populations. And so that was astounding to me. I'm like, wow, you know, so we kind of going backward.
Yeah. Yes, we are.
Yes. And, you know, and it sits home with me because when I when I started my company, and I have these students that I interact with, and so I'm trying to teach them entrepreneurship skills now, and they came to me. And so, okay, so one of the things I do is through my company, instead of outsourcing, I look to see if there's student talent around that I can harness to be a part of this, what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so my CAD files, I went to my students and I said, do you guys do CAD? And they said, oh yeah, we all do CAD. I said, okay, I want you guys to go form a group and I'm going to incorporate you guys as, you know, part of EPM, and you're going to do my CAD, but I'm also going to start shopping you around to other places. But at the same time, I want you to learn about entrepreneurship. The guy that I work with who represents my company, and he's going to teach you about entrepreneurship, because I don't want to be making your decision. I want you to be making sound decisions about business. And so, I told him that I want you also to come and get trained on the 3D printers, get trained on a whole bunch of other stuff so that you'll understand when you're designing a file, you know, how can you design a file if you don't know how a 3D printer works? You know how this system worked to design, because then you design the file better. And the students say, immediately, they sat back in their chair and they looked at me and they said, Dr. Kerr, we all just want to thank you right now. I say, I haven't done anything for you yet. They said, no. You know, we'll let you experience all this equipment. If you're willing to go in there and read the book, go read the book. We'll let you play with it. But them getting that skill, man, that's the best thing that you can have, because they're going to promote other students who want to come to your university.
They're valuable. They come in the door valuable just by declaring that major.
Yes.
They come in the door more valuable by sticking with it the second year. Yes. And then when they get to the point where they're doing research and they're presenting at conferences like EARN, and they're doing that stuff and they're excited about it, they have value.
Yes.
And we need to figure out we actually need to come up with a formula. We're going to work on this one offline.
Yeah.
How we determine what our value is as researchers, as scientists, as students of researchers, mm-hmm. and beyond the classroom. I mean, but in the classroom, we need to help them understand how to negotiate the world beyond the classroom. That's how they stay in the game. But being able to say, I'm worth this, and I will take no less than that, and be confident about it. Not, oh yeah, oh, you guys have the coolest lab. Oh, when can I start? Okay, we're going to pay you $22 a day. I don't care, you have the coolest lab. I mean, you know, but getting past that and not knowing how to negotiate your worth. That's why scientists don't make that much money. I mean, they're getting, you know, the person that manages the scientists or the people that manage the scientists makes a whole lot more money than probably the whole group.
Yep.
Combined, because scientists don't know their value, mm-hmm. dollar wise, and just even being a faculty member, faculty don't make money. I mean, they make some money, they don't get paid their value.
No.
When they're doing things like you are doing and other faculty members are doing around the country, and you know, mentoring students, doing cutting edge research, presenting at conferences, writing papers, writing books, and all of that stuff. That's a lot of work, first of all. Second of all, is building the infrastructure that keeps the universities going. Mm-hmm. It's maintaining. I won't say it's building new infrastructure to start new projects and new initiatives, such as the one you're doing. In closing, Dr. Curry, what is your best advice to give to other HBCUs so that they can start thinking about some of the things that you're doing and becoming a little more innovative about how the research is being done, how the students are being nurtured, how they will represent the university beyond the classroom?
So, you know, my advice, and since I've been going through this entrepreneurship training, I call it training because it has been a training experience.
Old JT.
And from a faculty standpoint, would be, number one, you know, look at your incentive programs. How are you incentivizing your faculty to come forth with their inventions? Because one of the things, you know, when I first made my discovery and I was thinking, you know, should I come forward with this? What's going to be the incentive for me to come forward with this? Am I going to be resistance? Are they going to be helpful? Or am I going to, you know, just waste my time? I should just move on to something else. All right. So how do you incentivize your faculty to come forward, you know, with their technology and to pursue, you know, technology? Number two, building your tech transfer office and having them in constant communication with your faculty members. Because, you know, one of the things I found out, this is not easy at all. And, mm-hmm. you know, just because you made an invention doesn't mean it's going to make it to the market. Because there are tech transfers, there are joint agreements. There's so much stuff that goes into, you know, getting something out to the market. You know,
right.
Partnering, are you going to partner with somebody? Or are you just going to try to sell the technology? I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to consider. And then, and for HBCUs, it is very critical that we get our tech transfer office, you know, together, you know, rock solid. Because number one, you know, when we're collaborating with those PWIs, mm-hmm. we need a rock solid transfer office that can communicate with them and say, no, this is our technology, right?
Right. And don't just believe what they're telling you. They're like, right. Oh, yes, we're partnered up. Yes, yeah. we have your best interests at heart.
Right.
Wink.
Because otherwise,
you know, I'm telling the truth.
Yeah, you're telling the truth. I'll be honest with you. Otherwise, it's going to get taken. And you know, with the and then educating your faculty on IP. Like, for instance, my very first technology, we kind of blew it because we published.
Mm-hmm. So student needs That's to what publish. Researchers do.
Right. And we published, not knowing that when you publish, you have 1 year from that point and if you publish too much of the information, now you can't file it.
It's open source at that point, huh?
And it's first to file now. So,
no. You
know, so if you disclose your event somewhere and somebody go file it, there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, guess what? I learned something you may know already from one of my other guests. He said there's such a thing as a provisional patent. Are you familiar with that? Really? So, yeah.
So,
if you don't know, you don't know.
Right. And I didn't know about a provisional patent. Mm-hmm. Until the lawyers got involved and said, hey, well, look, let's put this under provisional patent first. And mm-hmm. so it's like $150, $200. For a provisional patent.
Right. He said it was $130, I do believe. So it's very cheap as opposed to going through the process. Right. Let's close this thing out, Dr. Curry. We're going to get some people's products to market. We're going to get your product there first, of course. And we're going to get some students with degrees. And we're going to uplift these HBCUs. This is a monumental task that you just laid out here, Dr. Curry.
Yes, but...
But you seem to be up to it.
Yeah, we got to start somewhere, right? We're going to survive.
Absolutely.
Too many HBCUs have, you know, failed by the wayside, and it's, you know, because
unnecessarily, because the template is in place that's been there for the last 150 years.
Yes, yes.
Why? Oh my God!
Status quo. We got to break the status quo.
I just want to thank you for being on Beyond the Classroom, and I think that this was a very engaging conversation. And I know our listeners will love listening to us talk about this. We'll talk again, because this is something that cannot be solved in a day, but it's very relevant. And it's been a pleasure talking with you, Dr. Curry. And I look forward to many more conversations like this, and also to have you back on after you blow up and tell us how you got everything in place. You know, you have like 100 internships for students and all that under your corporate umbrella. And you're going around the country and you're doing tech transfer offices for all the HBCUs.
Thank you. Appreciate your invitation.
All right. Thank you. You've been listening to Beyond the Classroom with Dr. Trina Coleman.
Beyond the Classroom is sponsored by
Coleman Comprehensive Solutions. Problems solved. Questions answered.